Welcome to the 41st, maybe I'll stop counting, episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, and I have recently finished my scene-by-scene deep dive look at Hamlet through the lens of, yes, the text, but also film, television, comics, music adaptations. But today we're embarking on a new phase of the show, looking at singular adaptations that weren't part of the original corpus used on the podcast. And we start this adventure with 1921's silent era Hamlet, aka Hamlet, the Drama of Vengeance, directed by Sven Gade and Heinz Schall. And I'm not doing this alone, so here to discuss the film with me is English teacher and host of the Peacebound and Down Wonder Woman podcast, Mr. Sean Ross. Welcome back to the show, Sean.
Thanks for having me. The Drama of Vengeance, do you think these guys were the Michael Bay of their day? Was this like was this Die Hard with a Vengeance, just with Hamlet?
I think it sounds weird because it's probably a free translation from German. It's like those Japanese titles when you literally translate them. It's like, ooh, that's
like
a crazy
Super
title.
Hamlet Robot Go.
Ultra Hamlet versus...
I'd watch that.
Space Claudius. I definitely watch that, and I'm not sure it doesn't exist. You know,
probably does. If there's not a Gundam Hamlet, there will be by the time we finish this recording.
Actually, we're heading into the school year in the U.S.
Our school
year.
Well, it depends what part of the country you're in, but yes, in my part of the country, school year has begun. So we're well into it.
So it's a good time to have assignments, literary and cinematic, for students, including our listeners. So this is a version of Hamlet that is in the public domain. So if you want to watch it, and I'll ask you how you did, but if you want to watch this, I mean, the print is not lost, but different versions of it have been found over the years. So you can find them online, several ways to see it. For example, YouTube has the original with German interstitials and the original tinkts, the colored prints, but that's just German. I mean, if you don't know German, Vimeo has a black and white version with English interstitials and no music. But you can see that same version with music, pretty bad, plonky piano, honestly, on MIT's Global Shakespeare's Video and Performance Archive. I personally watched a version with English subtitles under the German cards with colored tints and live music. Like they were filming the screen and you could sort of see the orchestra underneath a little bit. And I still think that was the most authentic experience because I saw the real interstitials with translation. I had music, and the music was more modern than it might have been on other prints. So which version did you watch?
I originally watched the same one you did, the sort of the film of the film playing, and I struggled a bit. I liked the musical aspect of it. I liked what you said, too, feeling like I was in the audience and part of it. But it's at an angle, and so it is just it's just challenging in some ways to catch the full sort of scope of the scenes in moments. And so I watched it that way.
I agree.
And then I went to the Vimeo, which is, you know, a straight on recording. Like you said, no music. It's a much easier, in my mind, a much easier version to watch. I did miss the music. So I tried to play, I just put on like Spotify while I was watching it. And then at one really poignant moment in the play, Spin Doctors came on. And I was like, pocket full of kryptonite does not really work for Ophelia's death. And so I was like, well, okay, I'm going to turn Spotify off and just watched it without sound. But I definitely would recommend the Vimeo version just for ease and to absorb the performances more.
Right. It's actually watching the movie rather than sitting. Because I've gone to presentations like this. I've seen The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and at least that one, maybe a couple of others, in theaters with a band playing. You know, there have been some like presentations, Frankenstein, and it's like For Halloween or something in a local theater here. So I've done that. So it was kind of like that. And I was okay. It worked for me. But the method that you used, I've used that often when I'm watching some old silent film where the music score has been lost. I will put on other music and always enjoy when, somehow it matches at this point, or like it's got the same beat as probably the original music did or something. I love doing that as well. So it's a fun experiment. So I almost did it. I almost
there,
did
there
it.
There are some moments of synchronicity when you get the like Wizard of Oz, Dark Side of the Moon, you know, thing going on. But also those are, there are these very discordant moments where I'm like, oh no, that song just completely pulled me out of this. But it is fun. And I just very quick aside, my only real world experience of something like this is Rocky Horror Picture Show. So I don't know if that this happens in Canada, but in America, they'll show midnight showings of Rocky Horror Picture Show on the screen, and then people are performing in front of it. Does that happen in Canada as well?
Yes. I mean, wherever there's LGBTQ plus community, this certainly happens.
That's true. And that's a blast. I love it.
And I also remember, like, similarly, when I was in university, I took a couple of cinema history classes. This is back in the day, right? So we didn't have like DVDs. Criterion didn't exist, you know. So the professor, who was himself a filmmaker, really wanted to show full-length film. So you had the course and then you would stay after class to watch the whole film maybe. One of these was The Passion of Joan of Arc by Dreyer. So famous silent era film. And he would tape these off the television. The French CBC often had like a Sunday night cultural type experience. No commercials, these kinds of great films. He would tape them off of the television and then show them in class. Like the original score had been lost, so he hated what they put on. He thought it was like really sentimental, cheesy strings. And he said, so I'm just going to play it without the sound. So we watched The Passion of, like, watched The Passion of Joan of Arc without music. And when I watched it again on my own much later, so I just put on something else. Like I... So I respected the teacher's opinion enough that I, but it worked, like, for the most part. It's just close-ups of the actress's face, and it worked. It worked. So I think, like, the best of these films could work without a soundtrack. It's just, as audiences, we need to fill up the silence.
I think we're so used to musical cues telling us how to feel in movies, especially as modern audiences, that there is something sort of missing. But there was also something, I'll be honest with you, having watched it both ways, watched it with the music and without, I actually bonded, probably not the right word, but I responded to the film much more emotionally without the sound. It did force me to pay more attention to the performances and the actors' faces. And, you know, there's a sort of, obviously there's a style of acting in silent film. There's an overexpression on purpose. And it carries through when you don't have the music. It's really nice.
Because it's very theatrical, obviously, back in the day. And also the resolution, I guess, is, you know, the screens were kind of more dingy. And they came from a different tradition, a more theatrical, I'm on stage and you're in the back of the room kind of tradition. You know, so what makes this one interesting?
Because
we haven't really... We haven't really said it yet. What makes this one interesting is that Hamlet is a woman in this adaptation. Let me preface how this happened and why this is. And because, well, first of all, it's hard to do Shakespeare in a silent film, you know, because it's all about the text. And the interstitials can't be too long. And in fact, they don't use Shakespeare's text much at all.
There's a couple when he's talking to his mom in her chamber. But other than that, yeah, they're pretty free with replacing it with just straight dialogue.
Yeah. So when you're not beholden to the text, you can do anything. And this film often does. It's really based on Edward P. Vining's already at that time 40-year-old book, The Mystery of Hamlet, an attempt to solve an old problem, which posits that Hamlet was a woman either historically or in Shakespeare's intent. I'm not quite sure because I don't have that book. But it posits that Hamlet was actually a woman raised as a boy to preserve the throne, essentially. I did a bit of digging on Vining, and he was a self-taught armchair historian who made other spurious claims about the founder of Mexico, among other things. And according to the film's opening scroll, he was probably inspired by the great thinkers like those quoted there, Voltaire and Goethe, that Hamlet's attitude was unmasculine. And we can certainly talk about that.
Yeah, I hope we do.
Yeah, we will. So the film uses that theory to reimagine Hamlet as a woman raised as a boy to secure the throne when Gertrude thinks that King Hamlet may die or may have died on the battlefield, and inadvertently creates a trans narrative. And this is more than 100 years ago. So what do you think of the central premise?
So I struggle with it. It's interesting because Hamlet as a woman plays two ways. There's casting Hamlet with a female actor, leaving the character male, but using a female actor. That's one sort of path.
Right.
And then there's what this does, which is no, Hamlet was born a woman and pretends to be male all the way through her life. And that is so rife with so many storytelling possibilities, but I struggle because the root of this supposition for the author and then the filmmakers sort of picking up on it, and then you mentioned it, you know, with other thinkers, is that Hamlet couldn't possibly be a man because he's too reflective and, you know, erudite and, you know, emotional and you know, values life and the sanctity of life. And so there's really I struggle with the deep vein of sexism.
Oh, yeah. The misogyny inherent in, and I think Voltaire, known asshole. Goethe, I don't know enough about German philosophy, etc., but probably, you know. And Vining here, who just like taps into that. It's toxic masculinity.
The thing that's frustrating, quick aside, I now want known asshole on my headstone. I think that's just the best thing ever.
And as a French person who like was raised on, or at least studied mm-hmm. Voltaire as a matter of course, I'm deciding to say that.
But don't you think they miss a real opportunity here? If you're going to take that biggest swing, if you're going to say Hamlet was born a woman and proclaimed a man to preserve the throne, there are so many fascinating ways to take that story. And, you know, again, given the time, I'm not trying to be anachronistic and look back at with a 100-year different lens, but I just think they miss some really rife storytelling possibilities by really only playing the woman angle as, oh, she's more emotional, she's more hesitant, and she has a secret crush on Horatio. I mean, don't we all? So.
But ironically, this female Hamlet here commits to action sooner, actually gets her revenge on Claudius before the duel. There's like, those are major changes towards the end. So I feel like she is more active because it's also a silent film and we can't just sit there and talk. We need to see things. This is sort of if we're going to take like a revisionist approach to the story, which this does, it's kind of a tell-all, but because we can't say much, it's a show-all. So there's more action, which means Hamlet is more active as a female, as a outright female, than she was as a male, you know. I don't know if it's, I mean, what saves it for me in terms of the backstory of this is that Asta Nielsen, who plays Hamlet, she was a huge deal at the time. She was an international star. She had her own studio.
Oh,
she produced this. She acts in it. She distributed the film. That fact, it's like maybe the impetus for this thing or how they sold it to audiences, especially in that scroll at the beginning. Now, don't you love old movies where they say, hey, just want to warn you, this movie's weird, you know? It's like, they did that on through the 40s. Hold on, guys. Yeah, this is going to be... let me announce you the twist, you know? It's like the first novel saying, hold on here, each chapter is in a different voice. Don't be scared, you know? Wilkie Collins there. But... It's just the fact that she takes it on. She breathes life into it. She believes in it. She's producing it. Makes me believe like whatever, you know, Voltaire, Goethe, or Vining thought. This project is a little more sensitive than that. And it's not like you said, like it could have been just a woman playing Hamlet and there's no question of gender mentioned. And that had happened. Like, the very first person to play Hamlet on screen was Sarah Bernhardt in 1900. So it was like a Hamlet as a short, in 1900, that wouldn't have been a full feature film. But there's, of course, there's no mention that she's necessarily, that Hamlet is a woman. It's just the biggest star of the time playing Hamlet. And that she just happens to be a woman. So Asta Nielsen isn't the first. By any means, you know, it's like this is 20 years later. But nevertheless, we're going to lean into this. So it's like, let's take this interesting theory, which it is interesting, not necessarily like, of course, I'm a purist and I'm not going to like, I thought this movie was insane. But it's interesting to think that at some point, and, you know, Voltaire was in the 1700s. So that at some point, Shakespeare was out of favor. Shakespeare was thought of, you know, we know this. The thinkers of those eras did not think this was a masterwork. They took it to task for being outside of their own attitudes.
Yeah, the overly
and
maudlin, you know, and definitely, yeah, this Hamlet. This is one of the reasons it's in my opinion the greatest work of literature of all time, the greatest expression of the English language, is because of all of those lenses, because they're all valid. That you, it is completely valid to both love and hate this play. I don't know many people who fall in the middle. I don't know a lot of people who are apathetic about it. For the most part, if you've experienced it, you love it, you hate it. And that, to me, that's, it makes it great. But her performance is phenomenal. I mean, I do have to say, as bizarre a take as this is, she's really good at conveying, you know, especially given the medium of a silent film, you feel her attraction for Horatio. You know, you feel her awkwardness around Laertes at first, who's a much more masculine sort of figure. But then you feel her, you know, sort of jovial bond with Fortinbras, which is one of my favorite parts of this movie, who's a sillier, sort of dainty kind of character. So she does a really good job of sort of, you know, silent film code switching, for lack of a better term. And it's a really wonderful performance set within the context of a movie that just takes wild swings with the play.
There is a boyishness in the performance. A person who has been trained to act a certain way, but also refuses who they are. Let's talk a little bit about that. You know, the trance narrative that we now detect. And she does, I mean, there is one line. She says, I am not a man, and I'm not allowed to be a woman. That's a key line in this story. So it's transness without those terms, because people wouldn't necessarily be talking about it this way. But the movie, interestingly, I don't know if it's a quirk of the translation or it's maybe that's exactly it. The movie uses he, him, and his throughout. Even when they, like, obviously the other characters think of her as a man, except her mother is the only person who knows the truth. But the narrator says his whatever. So, you know, Hamlet is secretly a woman, even to the narrator of this. She has hetero feelings for Horatio, like you've mentioned, and none for Ophelia, except some sort of friendly sisterhood. And she feels isolated as a result. So it's kind of, we're going further than just the idea that, oh, secretly a woman, which explains the emotionalism of the play. You could make the same case that Claudius is emotional and they're all emotional. That's the whole point of Shakespeare. This is drawing
out
the emotional.
I mean, it's you know, the emotions are dialed to 11. And no, I think it's important. I think what you're saying is really important, is that she, the narrator, the pronoun piece was really interesting, because I didn't notice it on first watch. And then in the second watch, I noticed that the narrator was using male pronouns. And I was like, oh, that's fascinating. Like, obviously today that would be seen as a political choice. I think that was a narrative choice, because I like that idea of, like, even Hamlet's gender is obfuscated even from the narrator, because in a way, Hamlet's gender is not obvious to Hamlet. And it is that central moment in the play where Hamlet's like, I'm not a man, I'm not a woman, I'm not allowed basically to be either. And that for me is, that should have been the central struggle of this piece. I would have loved if that part would have been much more present. It's definitely there, and it comes up in really interesting moments. But that, for me, is the biggest draw to this, which is that, you know, the internal struggle of Hamlet, and all Hamlet is internal struggle. But it's not the, do I kill, do I not? You know, is life sacred, is it not? Do I believe this ghost, do I not? You know, am I my father, am I not? It's really that central conceit of identity, and it is handled very interestingly. I mean, for 1921, it's fascinating. I'd love to see a second shot of this today.
It exists. They do integrate it into the plot. It drives her depression, and they use that love affair with Horatio, which is probably, you know, a bit of a it's a distraction. It motivates the delay. She becomes distracted by this. So ahead of its time in many ways, even though in others, or it seemed in the genesis of it, it seemed retrograde. I do think it's super interesting that they do a revisionist take this early in the game. 1921, and we're already doing the truth about Hamlet. Well, what about
I love that. I mean, it reminds me of that. There's that great Onion article that says, experimental Shakespeare theater puts on play as set and in time written. I love that idea of, like, the most experimental thing you could do with Shakespeare is actually set it when it was actually supposed to be set. I do want to talk about those character interactions, though, because the relationship with Horatio is really, is interesting. And I will say, having taught this play for almost a decade during my career, almost invariably, I would have students, and it was always, I don't know what this says, but it was always female students. Students every year I taught this who said, oh, Horatio's clearly in love with Hamlet, right? Like, this is a Nick Carraway Gatsby thing. And I was always like, wow, that's, you know, and the first time I heard it, I was like, well, that's really interesting. And then I kept hearing it. And I'm like, okay, there's definitely something here. And, you know, and part of it's the sensitivity with which he treats Hamlet. They sort of care. And he's really the only character who maybe loves Hamlet. I don't know if it's romantic love, but there's definitely an undercurrent there. So I did love that reversal in this performance.
Yeah, Horatio seems to love Hamlet, but also resist loving Hamlet in that way, but does.
Yeah, and there's that moment. Did you get the impression that Horatio was aware that Hamlet had a romantic, in this piece, that Hamlet has a romantic love for him? Because there is that moment where they do show the dialogue and Hamlet and Horatio together, and Horatio says, I love Ophelia, and Hamlet says, more than your love for me. And he says, yes, it's greater because it's a love of a man for a woman. And so it's interesting because that read to me, you could read it one way, like you love her more than you love your best friend, or you love your prince, your country. Or was it pretty understood between them that Hamlet had romantic feelings for him?
Well, one of the key, some of the things I really enjoyed about this is when you know the play, what they actually did with the characters fits language from the play that they don't use in the film. So the idea that Horatio calls himself more an antique Roman than a Dane. In this movie, he's a Frenchman.
Yeah.
So they kind of mix up the geography, that's why it feels more like, okay, this are they saying this is like the historical Umlaut who did exist more than Shakespeare's Hamlet, which was based on, you know, whatever history/rumors from medieval Denmark, because it's obviously the medieval era, and then they change some of the things. Regardless, Horatio as an antique Roman. So I can't speak for Romans, but of course we all know about the Greeks, and so maybe this in their education, especially at university, their classical education, this seemed you could have a sort of romantic love for someone of your own gender. I mean, you still can, but that they would have been okay in their minds for their class, that this was possible in their time. But of course, you can't marry another man. So when he falls for Ophelia, okay, this is more of a sexual love than can be had with Hamlet. But at the end, when Hamlet dies, Horatio is all like, my love. So, like, he realizes there's a bit of groping there, kind of saucy pre-code kind of moment. But he realizes that Hamlet is a woman. And it's like, I think it creates a bonus tragedy where this was a doomed love from the beginning. And I didn't know how doomed it actually was. You know, it's like, now I know that it could have been.
Right. He shut his heart off to it because of societal norms, and then it turns out, oh, this was my great love all along, you know. But also, you know, and again, the beauty of Hamlet, right? It's always about layers, and even in this very changed narrative, that idea of, oh, this was, you know, this was, like you said, doomed from the beginning, you know, star-crossed lovers from the beginning. It's nice. It's a nice little Romeo and Juliet piece. There's a little As You Like It, you know, sort of gender play in here. It's fun. I mean, it's a fascinating piece. And Horatio for me is such an anchor character, even though he doesn't get a lot of character development in the play. In fact, he gets way more character development in here than he does in the play. I've always felt he was an anchor, sort of a moral anchor for the audience, as everybody else in Denmark is just spinning in their little dramas. And so it was nice to see him get a little bit of play in here as well. Pardon the pun.
Well, one of the things that we've talked about a lot on this show is the mirroring between the various boys. Well, just the boys, men, because there's also the mirroring between the Claudius and Hamlet Sr., which means a mirroring between the son and the father, the son and the uncle, and all of that. But also, Laertes and Fortinbras is sort of reverse Hamlets, and Horatio as part of Hamlet's psyche to many. And then you have the mirror of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. So the play definitely plays with those concepts. So having Horatio play parts of Hamlet's role, basically the Ophelia strand of it. He's the one who leaps into the grave to fight Laertes. So Horatio gets some of what would have been Hamlet's lines or moments.
It is an interesting choice. In fact, I sort of want to ask, what are your thoughts on Hamlet's their behavior towards Ophelia. Because there's that moment where Hamlet realizes that Horatio is developing feelings for Ophelia. So Hamlet literally looks at the screen and goes, well, I'll make love, meaning something different. Like, I'll woo her. I'll woo Ophelia to block this budding romance. And that mm-hmm. is a moment where you go, oh, that's right. Hamlet's kind of a piece of trash. Like, you know, there is that. Yeah. He is incredibly selfish and self-centered. That is very much an accurate reading of that character at times. But his treatment of Ophelia in the play is really questionable. But, you know, I've always gone back and forth on the level of blame he has given circumstance and maybe madness. But it's unequivocally in this film, he just has no concern for a fellow woman, has no concern for Ophelia. And in my mind, in the way that he treats her, I you may see it differently, but I think there's an extra layer of cruelty towards Ophelia from Hamlet in this film.
I guess it's an extra layer because it's a different layer, but he's always been cruel to Ophelia. And in this, yes, it goes further because there's a jealousy about Horatio, which kind of drives a sort of subplot in the film that isn't in the play. And then there's like that bit where like a parody mm-hmm. of the love letter where he decides, well, now I'm going to ditch Ophelia. Now she's in the way. I've stolen her away, but not really. And then Horatio keeps on coming. So it's like, forget it. Hamlet has this dream and that puts her back on track for the vengeance. And it's like, well, this can never be anyway. I had that feeling anyway. This can never be anyway. So she leaves Horatio to Ophelia, but she ditches Ophelia. Kind of like the love letter that we get in the actual play. You know, it's just insults, basically.
In the play, we've discovered the letter because Polonius reads it to Gertrude and Claudius, but we don't know how he obtained it. Like, we don't know for sure. Did Ophelia show it to him or did he take it from her? Here, you know, Hamlet gives it to Polonius. Like, here, give this to your daughter. So he is making a public spectacle of this purposely, which again is no concern for Ophelia as a human being. She is just a pawn in this. And there is, I don't know if this is a sexist thing for me to say, but there is an added layer of cruelty there for this being one woman doing this to another. Like, it's worse to me because of that. And I mean, I don't know if I'm right or wrong in that, but it's worse to me for that.
It's the trope of the catfight. But something that has been reinforced very much over the centuries and decades or however long we want to go back. Now women are much more tapped into a mm-hmm. sort of a sisterhood and we're all in this together. But they've been trained by media and attitudes. And we've had this discussion often with the Hot Squad over at A Lot More Not. Because they act as a sisterhood. But the idea that in a lot of movies or whatever, if there's a spoiler in the relationship, the women are against one another, even though it's the man who's cheating. I think it's kind of part of that. So in the script, this is 1920s. Makes sense for that time. And I think it is part of that misogyny, that sexism that we feel from parts of the premise, regardless of who is in it and who was driving it. So I agree with you. It's soft-putting, but in the play, Hamlet's a jerk as well, you know, especially when it comes to Ophelia. Ophelia is a pawn to all people. And even in this, where she doesn't have necessarily a pre-existing relationship with Hamlet, so it's not as bad in a way. We get the sort of like reverse Polonius, like in those scenes. Like instead of Polonius forbidding mm-hmm. this love, we get rid of all of that at the beginning. And
he's
now he's
basically...
Yeah, basically, it's the moment where he sends her into the hall with the book. And that's the start, rather than having a pre-existing relationship. And it's like the royals bring this to him, rather than him bringing it to them. And so there's like a kind of reversal, but it all will end at the same place. For him, anyways, I think, you know, he's killed in very much the same way. That's one of the moments it plays exactly like in the play, whereas most other moments
don't. And we do even get
don't.
The a rat, which is nice. When he stabs Polonius, but the Ophelia spin it was interesting as well because I think I said this when I was on a previous episode, but I had a professor in college who said I would give my right arm to know if Hamlet and Ophelia slept together, and I was like, oh, okay, that's fascinating. And he's like, I'm left handed, so I'm not giving up my good arm, but I give up my other arm. And I was like, wow. And as I taught that play year after year after year, I have those moments as well where oh my gosh, if I could go back in time and ask this question, I would. And that is one of them is, you know, did Hamlet and Ophelia sleep together? They don't, obviously, in this telling of it, but she is definitely it's on the table. Like if Hamlet, they think Hamlet's a man, Polonius and the king and the queen would have been perfectly fine putting her in the line of fire to whatever extent that was and to whatever extent of damage it does to her. So she's still a sympathetic character in this. I see her a little bit more, you know, on the episode that I was on previously for Act 3, the version we watched was the Simpsons short, the like 8 minute. And my favorite part of that short is Ophelia because it's just Lisa and there's no attention paid to her. And then randomly in the middle of the scene, she goes, Hamlet's acting crazy. No one out crazies Ophelia. And she goes, hey, naughty, naughty, jumps out a window, drowns in the river. And there's a little bit of that in here of like Ophelia's, you know, that's kind of, she serves a purpose in this narrative. She doesn't really get a lot of development.
The women in this play in particular are underwritten, especially compared to the rest of Shakespeare's plays, where often the female character, the female lead is the key to the whole thing and is the most developed. In Hamlet, it's quite the opposite. To bring it back to the boys, one of the things that made me raise an eyebrow as the film started is that they went a prologue and six acts. And I was like,
wait a minute, what?
Mm-hmm. And what they do, and this is how they bring a lot of these differences to the fore at the beginning, is that the prologue is the birth of Hamlet. There's a war with Norway, King Hamlet, and so on. They think he's going to be dead on the battlefield. And at the same time, Gertrude gives birth. It's a girl. She wanted a boy. She says it's a boy. And then they're kind of stuck in that lie because that's what they told the people.
So my question for you is, one, that's already a massively bold choice, right? To lie about the gender of the baby, complete diversion from the play. But are they locked into that choice? As soon as old Hamlet comes back from the battlefield, is alive, do you think they, and I know they don't because it's not the conceit of the film, which is fine. But I did have a moment where I'm like, yeah. Oh, they could have walked that back. They could have been like, oh, in her stupor after having given birth, you know, she made a mistake or I don't know, something. But it's just interesting to me that they continue the lie when they don't necessarily have to.
Well, we might, after all, does that secure the throne? I don't think it does, because if it did, Gertrude would need to marry Claudius to make sure that, you know, that there's a crown on the throne. She's still trying to have a boy, maybe
that's
even
what I thought
underage.
Too. Yeah, they kept trying and then would have just, I don't know, sent Hamlet away.
Because Hamlet on the throne, you have not secured the throne because Hamlet cannot marry a man and have a child who, like a son of her own. As a man. I mean, that would just have to be more lies.
I'd watch Hamlet the sequel. I would watch them, you know, however they did it. They have Horatio transition. And I don't know what they would do, but it would be definitely worth watching. I'm super curious, Siskoy, to get your opinion on the depiction of Gertrude in this piece. Because in the play, and again, this was another I'd give my left arm or right arm to know this thing. There's always that question of, is Gertrude a participant in the murder of old Hamlet? Does she help facilitate it because she wants to be with Claudius? Or there's a lot of questions. But anyway, is she a part of the murder? Mm-hmm. And it's unequivocal in this. I mean, she is absolutely murderous.
Definitely. Yeah. At the beginning, because this is what the Act 1 is here, the new Act 1 is Hamlet's youth. So we'll see her go to university, and I certainly want to talk about that. And then we see the affair and the murder. With some slight differences, it's a snake. It's a poisonous snake instead of a potion through the ear or whatever, but similar. She's having an affair, that's quite clear. She's in on it insofar as he tells her plans. She accompanies him to snake pit. So she's there, but she seems distraught that this is what
so
it's going to be.
Yeah, not so distraught that she stops it.
The man is still in charge here, but she does seem upset about it's come to this, that he's going to do it this way, maybe. I don't know. By the end of the film, let's keep that to the end. Let's keep that for later. But yeah, she definitely takes a villain
Hamlet
turn.
Needs to take that Mom of the Year mug back.
I want to talk about the university days, the college days of Hamlet, because they did this thing, which is, I mean, there's a controversial bit in Doctor Who lore, which is that all the renegade Time Lords, the Master, the Rani, Drax, whoever we ever met, they were all in school together with the Doctor. And some people think that's pretty trite. And I probably agree. And what's wrong with that generation, that cohort? But this is exactly what they do here, right? They all go to Wittenberg. Laertes goes there, not in France, not later. You know, he's a student there.
Yeah,
Fortinbras is a student there. And of course, Horatio and Hamlet. So they're all living in the same dorm. And by the bit, there's a lot of interesting bits there because Laertes, we don't really need that because he's kind of a non-character most of the time, but that he does have debts and Hamlet helps him and lends him money or, you know, gives him money, which is all the stuff that his dad says to him.
Is it a misreading? I wonder by the screenwriter or whatever, because Laertes is a gambler, Laertes is a drunk, Laertes is a womanizer. It's all Polonius. That's a Polonius speech that he's going to go and spread rumors to see if they're true. Laertes is, from what we know, a completely stand-up guy. So I was put off by this version of Laertes because I've always seen him as a much more noble character, flawed, but noble.
But it is a possibility, right? Like, I think it's supposed to show us like those different types, right? So Laertes is kind of this libertine. Hamlet is more reserved. Like they're all partying and she can't really follow those. Like they call her, they say she has clipped wings because she doesn't follow with the rest of the group because they're doing boysy things. But more interesting to me is Fortinbras because it's interesting. Like last episode, I had Gene Hendricks on. Mm-hmm. We talked about Act 5. And one of the theories that we spun, and I hadn't seen this yet, is what happens here, which is Fortinbras as a fellow prince that behind the scenes, Hamlet has roped into backing, in this case, her, backing her with his armies to take back Denmark. Hamlet is the true prince, the true heir to the throne, and Fortinbras, who is of that generation, decides to back her with his armies. That's why he comes in with his armies at about this point. It's why Hamlet says, he has my voice. When Hamlet dies, was there an alliance there that hasn't been really spoken of? Was there perhaps talks when Hamlet crossed paths with Fortinbras' army going to Poland? That's what I kind of said.
Yeah, it's a brilliant theory, and it does play to the dialogue at the end of the play. Fortinbras says, like, I have some ties to this country, and the I have my voice line is very revealing. So, yeah, it does, and I love the way they do it here. I mean, Fortinbras and Hamlet almost have a meet cute in this movie, which is great.
And at the end, like to foreshadow what happens later, instead of England as a banishment place, it's Norway, which makes a lot of sense for the region because it's just like today there's a bridge slash tunnel there, quite close. So that makes more sense than sending him to England. And it's England because it's Shakespeare, you know. And when Hamlet gets there, hey, it's my old pal Fortinbras.
I had a viscerally pleasant reaction to the two scenes of Hamlet and Fortinbras together. Because when they first meet at Wittenberg, they're in the room and it's really tense. And Fortinbras basically like, your father killed my father on the battlefield and our swords are dipped in blood. And then they both like pat each other and like have this really fun little like, but we're great, you know, and like hug. And then there's that moment again later on where Hamlet's been sent there to be killed. And changes the letter, you know, a little spin on the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern moment. And then they see each other, and at first it's very grave and what's going to happen. And then they're like, oh, old friend, and they hug. I found, even in this silent film, their chemistry was palpable and incredibly charming.
And it also taps into Fortinbras as written. He's not written much, but as written, the sort of ambitious prince. And in this case, it's like, you know, your dad killed my dad. Leaving the path clear for me.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to say that, but you can tell from also the performances. Like they took for Laertes and for all three of the other boys, they are taller.
Yeah.
They're manly men. They have these traits, these different traits. Horatio is more of a romantic. Laertes is more of a venal kind of person. And Fortinbras is a man's man. He's a warrior. He's the charismatic character in the bunch. And then you get Hamlet, you know, often sitting back, reflecting as an outsider because of her secret.
Accepted by all three. That I think is important because it does speak to something about Hamlet's character in this film, that while Hamlet is a woman, Hamlet is very comfortable in male spaces. And it makes sense because Hamlet's raised as a man. But there is definitely a tension and there's some depression and there's those pieces. But in the moments, Hamlet can hang, and I think that's really interesting. I think it's also maybe a little bit of a commentary on, like, Hamlet would make a good king, you know? Like, it doesn't matter what gender Hamlet was born as. And so, I don't know, I probably took it a little too far, but I liked that portrayal.
You're still correct, because one of the questions of the play is, who was mm-hmm. Hamlet before? Like, the friendships he has, and, like, when Rosencrantz and Guildenstern show up, and they're all kind of party boys, and he falls into that. It's like, that's who he was. That's who he was before the death of his father. The person who went to the theater, who had opinions, who was friends mm-hmm. with players. You know, so he has to be that person beforehand. So if you're playing Hamlet, and you're trying to create a backstory for him, it's all there. But it, you know, so he has to seem very different, like, for everyone to think he's gone mad or melancholy or what is this? Like, there's a real crisis. He can't always have been a sort of timid, melancholy character.
It's the Hal to Henry V arc, right? It's and it's beautifully right. condensed. And so I love that too. And it's funny, you mentioned the madness piece. One of the things I really like, a point I don't know if they're making purposely, but I'm going to assume they are, is that the melancholy of Hamlet is just accepted as the melancholy of Hamlet, where if Hamlet is known to be a woman, it's hysteria, right? She's hospitalized. She's sent away. Who knows what horrible things are done to her. So there's also, like, I don't know, for me, that was very present in this. Like the privilege to be mad is a very male privilege.
They do play with, like, this creates a mirror, obviously, uh-huh. with Ophelia, who is, in the play, the woman who goes mad. She goes mad here as well, walks into the river. That's kind of a haunting kind of image. I liked how when we see Hamlet's, you know, put on madness, I don't know, there was like moments where I felt, oh, this is very Ophelia-like. Playing with, she's got like origami things in a bag, and it kind of looks like she's playing with entrails, and the little crown that she brings up really looks like mm-hmm. a flower, which was like, put me in mind of Ophelia. So I thought there was like those kinds of moments. And the madness, I thought, was very, usually very entertaining.
Yeah, this is where some of the more feminine aspects of Hamlet would poke through, because there was a lot of like back of hand on forehead, staring forlornly, which is a traditionally very female posturing. And it was interesting. I agree with you. I think there was an Ophelia. Ophelia is always sort of surrounded by things, right? Like trinkets and flowers. And that, I mean, that is Ophelia. You know, a woman in water and flowers is Ophelia. And you're right. They do definitely adopt that same thing here with Hamlet, which is really interesting. And it makes me wish there was a little bit more of a connection between this Hamlet and this Ophelia, though. Like you said, the whole point of Ophelia in this version is, and in the play, is she is literally a piece of property to be traded. It's all the sadder for her.
That creates something interesting for this version, because if Hamlet had been a woman and had acted this way, they would have packed her off to the mm-hmm. sanitarium or something. Ophelia is that woman that goes insane. And so when Ophelia is left rudderless, without a father, without her brothers away, her lover has spurned her and her mind is broken. So Hamlet, in this story, has a picture of what mm-hmm. would happen to her, or how she would be treated. If indeed she was the princess.
Yeah.
There's some interesting things going on there. And the madness, I felt like they were playing it like they did in the mm-hmm. play as such. Because there's one moment, an invented moment. Polonius brings in a doctor. Right? The doctor kind of plays the role of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And later, when Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are supposed to bring Hamlet to Norway to get themselves beheaded. They're not named, but I guess they're conflated with Cornelius and Voltamand, mm-hmm. the ambassadors. Normally, there's not really a role for them. But the doctor kind of plays that role of kind of sounding Hamlet. And just in the performance, there's a lot of like book reading. So it's the mm-hmm. words scene. Like, where does it hurt? And I was like, it hurts here. No, it hurts here. No, it hurts here. It's like she keeps mm-hmm. changing her mind as to where the doctor should look, which is kind of the what would be done with words in the play. It feels warm. It feels cold. You know, it's like, I know a hawk from a handsuck kind of stuff. So I felt like it had the spirit of the play without using those words, which must have been a massive problem
to show
for the filmmakers.
And not tell, not to have the ability to tell the way the play, I mean, the language is so beautiful. I think one of the most effective translations from the play to this silent film is the madness of Hamlet. For that reason, exactly, you're right. They act out what the words are conveying, the meaning, if not the literal actions. And then Hamlet's madness is dangerous. There is an undercurrent of danger to it, that not only for those who don't know he's feigning, and he could, you know, madness could be dangerous, But we as the audience don't know if he's truly pretending. And then his madness turns to anger so quickly on Ophelia, on his mother, that there is this undercurrent of this guy, he won't go off when he needs to on Claudius, but he could go off any time on anybody else, and particularly women, the women in his life. And definitely it is conveyed as a more physical and, I don't know, I felt more danger in those scenes than I did in others. And I thought they did a really brilliant job of, like, a mad prince is a dangerous thing. And even though this is a woman playing Hamlet, and, you know, by 1921 standards, there's some sexism there. Even in this performance and even in this, the direction of this, there's real danger here. So I liked that a lot. I thought that was one of the more successful translations.
All right. Well, let's talk about the ending. The villainy, really, yeah, of this thing starts... It really starts with the wedding, because the wedding is supposed to be like 2 months after the wake in the play. It's the same time. There's like, it's the same event, you know, like it's the same party, and like she rips off her dark dress to show her white dress underneath. It's like, oh my God. And we get like a second beat of this at the end when Hamlet walks into Ophelia's wake, which is a big party. Everybody's drunk. Like, they're surprised that she's alive, of course, but she's faking that she's drinking, like throwing the glasses back, but making Claudius drink more. And then she sets fire to the place. And I'm thinking, well, I mean, now this is our active Hamlet. And you think, well, Claudius has to escape this fate, right? It's like, he's got to be there at the duel. No, no, he's dead. He dies. So the major difference there, which forces Gertrude to become the poisoner. She's the one in cahoots with Laertes because she wants revenge for her husband's death, which is to say Claudius's. So that's like a real heel turn there that I was not expecting. Do you think that works?
In this telling, it's a very Lady Macbeth, you know, sort of moment. It works in this telling. It's still shocking. I mean, when she is the one who's sort of serpentine around Laertes and like, we'll do it this way, we'll do it with poison, and really inhabiting, you know, not only the Claudius's words and actions, but Claudius, like he's always so sort of serpentine. It really does catch you off guard, but it bookends beautifully with the very woman who, upon giving birth and learning that her husband may die, lies to her entire kingdom in order to preserve her power, and then maintains that lie, and then participates in the murder of her husband, old Hamlet, to be with her new love and cement her power there. And does she love Claudius? Well, I mean, it seems like maybe she does, but there's also an element of like, he's easier to control. There's a lot of questions, but the through line of this play is every person in this play suffers because Gertrude is out to preserve her power. And then it's just right in your face at the end of like, oh, we're going to kill my son. And that, yeah, it's a little bit of a hard pill to swallow because it's so evil. It's just so in your, it's so Prince John. It's so in your face, but it makes sense in the narrative they've been building. So I was okay. I was taken aback at first, but then grew more and more to really like it. What about you?
Well, I think if this is a trans narrative in any way, she's already a murderer. She murdered Hamlet's true identity. That string of nihilism, where she negated her own child's identity. So there's something to that, and that may be, 2025 eyes looking at it. But of course, if she was in on it with the murder of Hamlet Sr., well, you know, this is a hop and a skip and a jump away from that. No, it's shocking as far as what we know of the play, like getting off the plot so much. I was surprised, but no, I thought it was maybe a little extreme, you know, and dramatically speaking, it's very melodramatic that this would suddenly happen.
It's a hard turn. I mean, it definitely is the thing that if you're either on board with it, if you're not, and it could really pull you out of this version of the story. So it is an interesting choice. And you know, it's funny. I just want to, the point you made about her sort of murdering Hamlet's real identity. So it's interesting because it's the one thing we haven't maybe said out loud, but we've talked about it implied a lot, which is this can very much be viewed as a trans narrative. But the key element here is Hamlet's not choosing to change their gender, right? Like this is being forced upon them. So you're right. That's fascinating. Yeah, that element of choice is so present here. And then Gertrude is the big bad. She's good though. The actress is good. I mean, she is grotesque at the end of this. Even physically, the way she contorts her face is, you're like, yep, she's evil.
And let's be clear, when I say it's a trans narrative, in a true trans narrative, you know, Hamlet is born biologically male. But no, she's female. Obviously, that's not what's happening here. But it's as if, is what I'm saying. And then, of course, Gertrude doing this, she has to drink from the poison cup herself by accident. So it's a little clumsy in a way, but we just need to get to that ending with her dead. Everybody's dead. Hamlet's dead. Her secret finally exposed. But nobody makes a big case out of it except for Horatio there. A lot of differences. It took us like an hour to get through them. But super interesting ones. I think it's worth it. I really want to talk about the performance by Asta Nielsen. I think we should do this every such episode. You know, who plays Hamlet? That's a big thing. And there's no particular line readings here. So it's not like I don't want to go through every character and what we thought of them if we haven't already spoken about them. As for Hamlet, I mean, the woman could be a Tim Burton character. Right? She immediately draws the eye. She has a more naturalistic style than most of her colleagues. In terms of acting, I think her haircut is perfectly stylish for 1921, but great match for a medieval boy's hair. So she's not stuck in a fright wig like a lot of the others. So that's all very good. But I want to signal, like mention, spotlight a couple of her best moments. I love when she's gripping the tomb of her father, and that replaces a whole soliloquy, basically. Right? It's the first soliloquy, essentially, but it's just that representation. I love her in the mousetrap because there's talk of a snake. The poison is a literal snake. So they're doing the snake bit and she's crawling.
Yeah, slithering all around Claudius. Yeah.
Slithering. Yeah. Just like a snake looking at the royals. And in fact, here we do see, like when we're talking about Gertrude's villainy, Gertrude seems more upset than Claudius. In that moment at the play. Like, those are some great moments that she has. Great physicality, great expression. So I can see why she was such a big star at the time. Of course, today we don't necessarily talk about silent film stars all that much, or very few of them. You know, I'm sure she was a bigger deal than we now realize. But yeah, those are some of my favorite moments.
Yeah, Do you have any? Again, her performance is stellar. And there's a couple in particular. There's a moment early where Gertrude and Hamlet Sr. are watching Hamlet from, like, not a parapet, but from, like, a stairwell on the outside of the castle, and Hamlet's sort of below them. And Hamlet is almost, like, sunbathing. Not sunbathing, but, like, almost. Like, is kind of enjoying their body. And they have incredible legs. Like, I just, you know, like, this actress has an incredible, you know, just beautiful legs. But it's a very feminine moment. She's inhabiting a very feminine moment. And then immediately changes when she stands, realizing she's around other people, even though those people know her secret, but though Claudius follows quickly upon, she immediately then inhabits the male persona. And it is such a great bit of physical acting to go from, you know, what feels very feminine to what feels very masculine, which is, again, the heart of this whole piece. So she does a brilliant job there. I think she's phenomenal. And then again, I think the moments where she allows Hamlet's true deeper emotions to emerge without his sort of choosing are really great. So, like, when she bumps heads with Horatio at Wittenberg, and that's how they meet, and sort of jokingly says, like, well, the head you just bumped is going to wear the crown of Denmark. You're not my bodyguard. There's this flutter in her eye. There's this sort of, I just met somebody I'm going to love for the rest of my life element to it, which is really hard to convey. I don't even know how you do that as an actor, but she does it. And then same thing when she meets Fortinbras for the first time, that switch from, like, very self-serious to very giddy and silly and schoolboyish. And so I just think she is a real master of transitioning from one emotional state to another, and having the ability to do that without dialogue, and potentially, well, I mean, I watched both versions. I watched the Vimeo version with no music, with no musical cues, is really amazing. Like, she is a great actor and does a brilliant job in this role. So, I mean, it really carries the film because, again, as somebody who, like you, I'm a bit of a Hamlet purist, the swings they take are so big that normally, if done differently, what might have really pulled me out of this. I went along with a lot of them, or at least was willing to humor a bunch of them, because she's so good, and she's so good as the thing that holds the whole film together. So, phenomenal.
Yeah, just the way that she's acting as a detective, you know, because there's no ghost in this. We haven't talked about that, but there's no ghost. There's no supernatural element. Like, she claims having a dream at some point, but the reason that she suspects is that
his knife, his dagger,
near the snake pit. She asks some questions. She's being a detective, and so that really makes the mousetrap more necessary. It's not another delay. Okay, Hamlet, you know this happened. You don't need another proof. No, she actually does need the proof because it's all circumstantial. And then so the mousetrap is more justified.
And it's clever, basically, because it literally is a mousetrap. And I liked the removal of the ghost in this case. It grounded the play a bit more for me. Did you like it, or do you wish that they had found a way to do it?
No, I was fine with it because I did feel that they set it as the true history of Hamlet. A little bit like, I'm not saying there's no supernatural element in it, but a bit like the Northmen, right? It's like supposed to be, okay, what was the real story absent any Shakespearean fluff in there, right? So in the real history, I would not believe the ghost really exists. Like that's a really dramatic conceit, the ghost. So having no ghost, but still having Hamlet Sr. in it so that we understand the background, which the ghost might have brought. No, that worked for me. That's not a problem. Are there any other characters in the film that you want to spotlight and say, this was interesting?
They make Polonius even more foppish as sort of the comic relief, you know, and he definitely is at moments in the play, though, you know, he's much more dangerous in his ignorance than, you know, in the play. But the moment when Hamlet like basically turns him into an ass, you know, like puts the items on him in front of the doctor and is just mocking him sort of brutally. I liked that sort of, if you weren't going to expand Polonius's role or make it as pronounced as it is in the play, I like keeping that through line of him as this sycophant. I thought that was really good. I would say Claudius physically looked like a villain. I mean, they do a good job of making him very, like, you can almost hear him growling in every scene. But he wasn't as imposing, I think, as I would have liked. So I wouldn't have minded. And I guess that's true to the play, because old Hamlet is Mufasa and Claudius is Scar. But, you know, so he's not as physically imposing. But I don't know. I guess I would have liked a little bit more from the Claudius actor. But otherwise, I mean, Gertrude's brilliant and the cast is phenomenal.
I would also spotlight those two characters, basically, because Polonius, a couple of interesting things. They specifically make him the treasurer, which ties into all the financial advice that he gives his son. So I kind of like that little bit. And they did keep his disdain for the players, which I feel is like in the actual play is kind of his best moment, where he gets humiliated in front of people that he disdains.
I used to call it his Bubba Gump moment, where he's like pastoral, you know, pastoral, floral, and when he starts just listing types of plays. And it was always such a fun moment of like, oh, he's so stupid. He's so ridiculous.
And then as for Claudius, he's really villain-coded with the makeup and such. But you're right, he turns out he's not the ultimate villain of this. So it makes sense that he's maybe less imposing, but it is a weaker performance than some of the great Claudiuses. One moment that's interesting here is the confessional scene, because we don't get into his head. They omit that moment where he admits that his prayers are empty. So is this really a repentant Claudius? This is a question that I would ask of this character. Like Hamlet refuses to kill him at prayers, but we don't get the irony that the normal
that
scene
he's not actually
would
repenting,
bring.
Yeah.
We don't know, right? And there's one really cool design element. His robes, at some point, not all the way through, I don't think, but at some point, his robes look like they're tattered. Like the sleeve has some, like these icicles on it type of element. And I felt like, oh, that relates directly to the line, a king of shreds and patches. So they're just like these little Easter eggs. If you know the play, it's obvious the filmmakers knew the play. And what they couldn't really do with the text, they might have inserted
dying,
in there.
Maybe not the best choice, but even dying in a fire as a precursor to the hell he will experience after his death because he's not repentant is a nice touch. I mean, again, it forces a hard turn by Gertrude, but it is a nice symbolic touch, especially in a silent film, to be like, oh, these are the flames he's going to live with for eternity.
While he's drunk, which is one of the sins that Hamlet accuses him of, you know, and it's like drinking from the cup of the cup of wine of poison. We have Hamlet forcing wine down Claudius's throat. It's not the poison wine, but it's what would have happened
when
in the
Claudius
next scene
is so
anyway.
Guttural in this. Actually, I'm talking myself into liking this performance more on this very podcast because he's so guttural. Like I said earlier, I could kind of picture him growling in every scene. But when we first see him, you know, he's partying. And then we see him so much in a state of animalistic inebriation. And, you know, it's the to the manor born line from the play. It does depict him as more of a creature of the profane, like a creature of bodily desires and being willing to go lengths for that, which is also, again, then speaks to Gertrude as like, well, this is the guy you wanted. So it's just interesting. It is like Hamlet. It is more and more interesting upon, you know, rewatching and analysis.
Definitely something of the satanic. Instead of poison, it's a literal snake. They're doing something there. One of the things they're not doing, which I'll mention here before moving on, is that, like we were saying, there's no ghost, right? And maybe that brings us to our next feature, because I wanted to do this every episode, which is ask, did they nail the big moments or the big elements, right? And in this, because they're off script, that may not be... that may not be an interesting avenue of discussion, but I'll say the moment so that it creates a structure for future episodes. But the ghost appearance,
there's no
ghost, so no. But what I wanted to say here is that the production, it surprises me that there's no ghost because of just like the German style generally, that they're so known for those sort of expressionistic horror films, that the fact that there's no ghosts here and no sort of hallucinatory sequence,
even a dream sequence. Yeah, I expected something. So the complete removal of it is not even surprising, but effective.
But I'm sure the famous German films like Nosferatu and so on, maybe we're pigeonholing the whole of German cinema of the era into that style. And it's just not the case, right? So, okay, we live, we learn. The other elements here, I had like the mousetrap. We see it from afar. But I love Nielsen's performance as the snaky Hamlet in there. I think, yes, with the means that they had, with what they could do, they did nail it.
Like we said, Hamlet's being so serpentine, almost taking on Claudius qualities in that scene is great. And then one of my favorite parts of the mousetrap scene is the opening when they're shuffling in and he puts his head on Ophelia's lap and it's really bawdy and really pretty inappropriate. And they act that part out too, which I thought was a nice addition. So no, they definitely nailed the mousetrap.
I thought they would do more with the, you know, because the play actually does start. I mean, the mousetrap really does start with a silent sequence.
Yeah, the dumb show.
Right?
Yeah.
In the play. And I thought they would do that, but we don't really, not really, you know, not really. Then I had Polonius's murder, which is pretty on point, even with Claudius's selfishness in that moment. I thought it was always perfect. It's like, it would have been me. That was meant for me.
It is such a great moment in the play where, like, that's the first jump he makes. It's like, wait a minute. Forget Polonius, my loyal subject. That was supposed to be me. No, I mean, it plays out the way it plays out in the play. So they do definitely, it's there. That scene is missing a lot for me, though, because that scene is so dependent on Hamlet turning Gertrude's words against her. And they do include, son, you speak with a wicked tongue, you know, mother, and that whole piece. And then as bad, dear mother, as kill a king and marry with his brother. They include those lines, which is good. But that scene doesn't carry for me the way it needs to. That was one of the more obvious suffering for lack of language moments. But, you know, the murder is the same as it plays out in probably every depiction of Hamlet.
What about Ophelia's madness and suicide? Was that enough for you, walking into the water?
Not so much, because again, I missed the, you know, these are pansies there for thoughts. I missed that in the song. But the power of, because they don't show it in the play. It's a gravedigger, right? Like references it in retrospect.
And Gertrude
so to see
tells
her,
it.
You know, and then you're like, oh, this is suicide. Unequivocally, this is suicide. To see her walk into the water was actually one of the more powerful scenes for me. So I thought that was really effective.
I agree with you. That's like we're missing a whole bunch. Like Ophelia is a nothing burger in this. And I felt like, wait, where's Horatio, you know, after this happens? It's like it's a lot of Laertes being sad, but Horatio, who was in love with her, like eventually he leaps into her grave to fight off Laertes. Great. But for a while there, it's like at least Horatio never feels resentment towards Hamlet about this situation. Yeah,
exactly,
it should have been more complex there. The fight scene, like to me, fairly unremarkable with the means that they had. But I do love Hamlet's death pose at the end. The arched back. That's a great engraving.
Yeah, it's a great silhouette. It lingers in the brain. Exactly. The fight scene is okay. The biggest piece of that fight scene that lingers is Gertrude's villainy. And then, you know, Hamlet's death is well played. But again, I missed, and they I don't remember the exact wording. They truncate it a little bit. But I miss the Horatio cradling, you know, flights of angels sing thee to thy rest moment. I think it's such a, I mean, I know they kind of replace it, like you said, Horatio saying like my love. And so they convey it maybe even more powerfully and directly than Shakespeare does. But there were like a few moments where I couldn't divorce myself from my, and this is just me, like my love of the language, you know. So I, for the most part, I could let go. I thought they did a great job. The other thing I would say they shortchange, there's a soliloquy moment where they literally, within like a minute of film, go from the to be or not to be, you know, to sleep perchance to dream moment to from now on my actions be bloody or nothing, you know, or nothing else. They go, it's like such a quick jump of Hamlet kind of looking at like, maybe I'll slash my wrist to like, no, I'm going to slash Claudius. And that part for me was like, oh, wow, they really had no idea how to address those moments.
They truncated that. I do like, though, that, like, of course, like my last question would have been, did they nail the soliloquies, which yeah. They can't do, right? It's just, they can't do it. It's just not the format, just not the right medium. That bit that you're talking about where she contemplates suicide, to me, it was about evocation. So, okay, here we're evoking that first soliloquy at the tomb. Here we're evoking to be or not to be. She's going from should I or shouldn't I, you know, it's just evocation done with gestures and expressions and very little text. Knowing that this is, you know, this was the problem of this version, and it would have been the problem of any version in the silent era, regardless of whether or not they did a gender bender on it. You're just stuck with that. It's like if you reduce Hamlet to the plot, how do you fit these things? How do they work? But you're right.
It's
they
so
go
fast.
From one soliloquy to a later soliloquy because there's no, in the exile, there's not that moment where she meets the armies of Fortinbras because Fortinbras has to be there when she's sent to Norway. So all of that has been collapsed.
I think I would have been okay with it if they had just buffered it out a little bit more. Like there, it's so one to the next that for me was the jarring part. Cause I was like, well, this moment's not earned. Like, why is she suddenly going from considering slashing her own wrists to no, I'm going to go murder him. Like why this quick turnaround? And I just needed a little bit more and it didn't have to play out the way it plays in the play. In fact, I think the whole sailing to, you know, from England pirate thing is one of the weakest parts of Hamlet. I just needed something though. I needed some, and they were already taking big swings. So I feel like they could have fit that scene in. I feel like they could have cut down a little bit on some other stuff and maybe just made that mental and emotional transition clearer. But other than, you know, but like you said, it's without the words, it's tough.
I think the original play is about a man who is struggling with his impulse for vengeance and his moral certainty that vengeance is wrong. I think that's probably the core of that. All the talking, you know, he has to work it out for himself and he has to prove to himself that it's okay to do it. That's the drama. That's not the drama. The drama is I am a woman in a man's body or in a man's role. And that's what causes the delay. I think she's much more active. She's a detective. She figures it out. She proves it. And then she does it. But what delays the action is not a sort of self-reflection, is not wringing your hands with shouldn't I. You know, what delays it is those subplots, is I am, in fact, not only a woman in a man's role, but in love with another man who doesn't know I'm a woman, and he's in love with someone else. also. So it becomes like I am not doing the vengeance because I'm distracted by all these other things. Because my real drama, I want vengeance, but my real drama is what I'm calling the trans narrative. So when you're watching it, it's like, oh, there's like this big parenthesis where in the play we have to take a break to do this whole big subplot thing that is not necessary to the action. Just as in the play, you're taking those breaks to listen to Hamlet talk to himself, talk himself into doing something, and then not succeeding at convincing himself. You know, so it's the same. There's a delay. There's obviously going to be a delay. It just comes from a different source. It's motivated by a different internal drama.
Honestly, a brilliant observation because it also is an example of form fitting function. Because in a silent film, you don't have the language. So the entire structure of the play, which is we're going to use language to process our emotions and then dictate our actions. It's now, no, we're going to take actions. And then the actions, like you said, will drive the plot forward pretty succinctly. And then we'll build in these other moments, but they're all still really action driven. Yeah, it's great, actually. It's really, I, upon first watch, was like, oof, I'm struggling. And then watching it again was really, really taken in. And then I do love the luxury of looking back on it as a trans narrative, because I think it's such an effective one. It's a powerful one. I'm actually going to do some research after this to see if anybody has taken this tact again. I'd love to see a modern version of this.
And it's very Shakespearean as well. Women dressing up as men to be more active in the world. And that happens in a lot of plays. So they're not too far off. And I do wonder, like we said, oh, it's a very misogynistic premise, the way they set it up, or the reason they might have set it up, let's say. But at the same time, is it, well, were they looking for a way to do this in silent cinema? And this was a way to make it less wordy?
I'm just really captivated by the boldness of this, even more so now that you've explained the history, that the lead actor, she not only starred in it, but, you know, produced it, funded it, distributed it. Obviously, this was a real passion project. It makes it even more potent given the time and more powerful given the time. I'm going to wax Hamlet's car, as I always do. But, you know, for me, the thing is the beauty of Shakespeare, but especially Hamlet as a piece of writing, is always with each new reading, with each new performance, some new layer of humanity, of human nature is revealed or may be revealed. And this is a great example of that. And I think is absolutely worth watching, especially if you know and love the play. And in particular, you said this, and it really resonated with me. If what you love about the play is the language of it, this is a really incredible example of the other strengths of the play, like that the language, the play is more than its language, and that, you know, acting is its own kind of language and communication. And so I really am so thankful for you for inviting me to do this, because I didn't know there were still, you know, I thought I had watched or discovered most of what was out there to be discovered. And so this was a real treat.
There's more than 100 films called Hamlet. Never mind variations on the title. Like, that doesn't count, you know, Kurosawa's The Bad Sleep Well. So it's not, you know, so there's tons of Hamlets out there that we haven't seen that may or may not be available, of course. Yeah, I felt like, I'm going to say this isn't Hamlet in the sense that they changed the story and we don't have the actual text. And to me, yes, the text is very important to Shakespeare, but I've liked adaptations of it where they don't use the text, because it makes me realize, it's a little bit what you said, but it makes me realize that the plots, which in the past I've said were like, well, they're borrowed from other sources, and he might have rewritten like this Italian little play or something, you know, really it's the text and how it reveals the internal workings of the characters that makes it Shakespeare. But doing this show and talking about, you know, each scene almost at too long a length.
Very Hamlet of you.
Yeah. There were many points where I said, well, you know, it's that structure, it's that plotting element that actually says something more so or as equally as the text does. There's like a nuts and bolts element to Shakespeare's plays that make them great as well. It's not all about, not just a poet. He is a dramatist. And the way that, yes, the dialogue, yes, the text, but the way that it is structured and what happens in the plays is equally important. And I think, yes, this is a good example of that. Now, I will leave like the versions that we watch, I'll put the links in the show description at fireandwaterpodcast.com so that you can experience it for yourself. It's only like 2 hours, you know, once you cut out the dialogue. Hamlet is cut down by half. But yeah, it's a lot of these little moments that I think every time you would watch it, you would catch new things, because you do have to interpret, you know, you have to look at the performances and interpret things as, oh, they're doing that bit from the play, which isn't necessarily at the same spot or doesn't really have the same meaning at this point because the characters have been transformed so much. I did enjoy it as a sort of Elseworlds Hamlet.
Hamlet. That's great.
Sean, thank you so much for doing this with me today. Tell the folks what you're working on right now.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm addicted to this show. Your analysis of Hamlet's been brilliant. It's my favorite play, favorite thing ever written. And so this has been so much fun. And I feel very fortunate that I've been able to be on the show. And in particular, again, to watch this version. You can find me on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I host a show called Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, where we cover seminal runs from Wonder Woman, beginning with the George Perez written and drawn run from 1987. We're a year in, actually, at the time of this recording. I just uploaded my 1 year anniversary episode. So that's really fun and exciting. And you know, I really am enjoying being part of the network, and I'm really enjoying hosting the show. And I, again, am super thankful to be a part of the show. Again, not only because of how much fun this is, but now I have my epitaph for my tombstone. I'm going to immediately go from this recording to tell my wife, hey, by the way, no more beloved father and husband. It's got to be known asshole.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks again to my guest, Sean Ross. Next time, we'll cover another full adaptation of Hamlet. To be determined. I've got to talk to some guests, some possible guests, but there are a few in the pipeline already. It's just about scheduling. Meanwhile, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, of course, head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com. Let me know what they are. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWpodcast. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll return for the next episode of Hyperion to a Seder!
Is silence.